Thanks for listening to the Stimulate Run podcast. If you like what you hear, remember to subscribe, leave a rating and a review. If you would like to get in touch or have future guest suggestions, please make contact via email or slide into DMs on any of the social channels. Here's your host, Erwin, with this episode's guest.
All right, listeners, another special treat. I know I say that every time, but this episode's guest, I've actually just told him off air that I've been kind of following him from a distance for a couple of years. And then as soon as I saw him running with a mutual friend and he also completed Comrades, I thought, no, I've got to try and find and make contact. So I'm glad it's eventually eventuated. He is a federal member of parliament. So it'll be good to get into, I suppose, the backstory of how he eventually got into this role. He's a Harvard graduate, a former economics professor. He's an author. So fair little resume he has going on, a running resume, which is just as impressive. So he has a 2:42 marathon PB. He might correct me if I'm wrong on that as we go. He's a 6-star major finisher, and he is a Comrades silver medalist, which I think from my personal view is one of the more impressive on his total resume. But welcome, Andrew Lee, to the Stimulate Run podcast.
Thanks so much, Erwin. Great to be with you and your listeners.
So do you want to, I suppose, give us a bit more of a background on who you are and how you sit where you sit now?
Sure. So best place to start is my grandfather, Keith Lee. He was a Methodist minister in Melbourne who was pretty passionate about social justice and a crazy runner. On his 50th birthday, my grandfather ran 50 miles from the city of Melbourne out to see his mum in the nursing home in Dandenong and then back again. The running bug came from him, and the social justice values carried down as well. My dad was a keen marathon runner who ran the Boston Marathon when he was studying over in the States. And also my parents instilled in me a sense of social justice. I got into politics because it seemed a way of making a difference on the issues I cared about around poverty and disadvantage. And I've continued running because being involved in a running community is a great way of engaging with people. And also because it sets me up for the day. My best days start with a run in the bush for about an hour, listening to the kookaburras, seeing the kangaroos, smelling the eucalypts. And it's pretty hard to have a bad day when you've started like that.
How, you know, I dare say when you made this call to leave your former life, were there colleagues just saying, Andrew, what are you doing? You know, you're at the peak of your powers and now you're going into public life. That's the first part of the question. So if you want to go from there, and then I'll have a second part from that question after.
Well, I did have a colleague who said, no, this is great. You're going to raise the average IQ of both professions, which tells you what he thought about me and what he thought about politicians. But I've really loved it. And I've aimed to connect with academics, not just by going for a run with former colleagues when I can, but also by being there at conferences and trying to be a bit of a transmission belt to take ideas from academia into politics. Now, part of the reason, Erwin, I've continued writing books since I've gotten into politics is to keep a foot in both camps and finally managed to link together my sporting passions and my political passions last year with a book called Fair Game about how sport can help us build a fairer society and a stronger economy, which allowed me to indulge my passion for telling running stories John Landy stopping for Ron Clark or Peter Norman standing on the dais in 1968 with the Black Power runners, as well as talking about the values of sport and how it so wonderfully combines excellence and egalitarianism.
It sounds like you're always earmarked for public life. You know, was there ever a moment, I suppose, did somebody have a conversation that moved you? And, you know, you might have been sitting as a professor and going, it's time to do this. What was that thought process like? You know, did you speak to your wife? What really made you make that pull to go, right, we're in, let's go?
Oh, I love that question. Look, I reckon for everyone who's serving in parliament, there's probably another 200 people in their local electorate who are talented, capable and keen to take the role. And what often separates the person who's in Parliament from those who aren't is luck. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time to run in an open pre-selection against seven other candidates when Bob McMullen, who'd been the member before me, stepped down. But I look around the Parliament and there's relatively few people who were always destined to get there by hook or by crook. Most of us are there because we were fortunate enough to have the opportunity. And that's always worth bearing in the back of your mind, Erwin, the notion that that you're fortunate to have this job, to be serving your friends and neighbours in the federal parliament. And the moment that you you start complaining is the moment that you should step down and offer the role to somebody who's more enthusiastic. Now, you've always got to think about a job like this as a privilege and never a right.
Do you? It's quite interesting. So many parallels to different worlds, it seems. You know, you look at sports coaches, and I heard an analogy of a sports coach is actually closer to being sacked than being re-signed. And, you know, do you almost look at it and go, okay, I've got a time between I've been elected to when re-election possibly happens, and now I've got this amount of days or years, and I might not be coming in and sitting on this chair. Then it's not like a normal role where you can actually get into a comfort zone, is it?
Yeah, I mean, you get a three-year contract, renewable on the discretion of your friends and neighbours. So there is something unusual about that nature of things, and it certainly focuses the mind. I'm very aware, having now at the age of 51, of the importance of leaving something behind for my kids, for my family, for the broader community. And so you think hard about what we economists call comparative advantage. What is it that I can do that maybe other people wouldn't be able to do? And I'm really conscious of pursuing those things in politics, whether that's working with Rob De Castella's Indigenous Marathon Foundation in order to provide a platform for his squad, or whether it's working on areas like competition policy and multinational tax, which tend to be the bread and butter of what I do within my party.
Would your school teachers,
Sorry, Erwin, I just missed that question. Would you mind asking one more time?
Yeah, so if I went back to your school teachers tomorrow and asked them, or your parents or university lecturers, do you think that they would say, no, he was destined and we could see this was going to eventuate? Or do you think, yeah, they would say completely opposite?
Oh, like they would say he's a bit of a political tragic and so he was always going to give it a crack. But that is said about many more people than have the opportunity to serve. It's interesting, though, you talk about school. I was quite a keen athlete in school, first as a race walker and then as a runner and then as a triathlete. And then gave it a pretty big break through my 20s and 30s and really just sort of exercised a couple of times a week before coming back to it with a bit of a passion in my 40s.
Following a cause seems significant for you. It's like, you know, a lot of people, and rightfully wrong, like they run for themselves and whereas you seem to get added motivation running for a cause. The Indigenous Marathon Project, how did you link in? What has it kind of meant for you, even in, I suppose, the real pits of a marathon? How has that helped you significantly kind of fight through in the end?
So Rob De Castella was one of my childhood heroes. And when I was first getting into running, it was all in order to run Point to Pinnacle, what's dubbed the world's toughest half marathon. Starts at Rest Point Casino in Hobart and finishes at the top of Mount Wellington. It was significant to me because my grandfather, who I spoke about at the start, Keith Lee, died in 1970, 2 years before I was born, doing a fundraising run up Mount Wellington to raise money for a charity called the Methodist Million. Now, I never met him, but I was really inspired by his stories and so got together a group of Keith Lee runners in 2015 in order to raise money for overseas aid in Keith's memory. in the process of training to do an uphill half marathon, it occurred to me it probably wasn't that much tougher to do a flat full marathon. So ran the Canberra Marathon, then Gold Coast, and then at the end of that year, Sydney and New York, and got hooked on running, inspired too by Rob DiCostello's Indigenous Marathon Foundation. To work with Rob is to be surrounded by a group of people who have incredible personal stories and extraordinary grit. So in the Gold Coast Marathon in 2015, I started the race despite having a bad cold and being dehydrated, and was cramping by halfway. Ordinarily, I would have pulled out, but I was wearing an Indigenous Marathon Foundation singlet, so decided to push on to the end. And it's those really tough races, Erwin, I think really, really stay with you. Same thing happened a couple of years later when I was running Chicago and was in quite a lot of pain. I hadn't realised at the time I had stress fractures in my hips. Turns out it's not a great idea to run a marathon if you've got breaks in your hips, but who knew? And as I was going at about the 30K point, sort of struggling through, I felt a pat on my shoulder and a bloke say, "Stay strong, Andrew." And it was Charlie Maher, the first Indigenous Marathon Foundation graduate to cross the line in New York after Rob set up the squad. And after Charlie had clapped me on the shoulder, I figured the least I could do was to finish the race. So it's been a great inspiration. I've raised money for them, but I've gotten so much more out of the foundation and its participants than I've given to it.
How do you, I suppose when you go out into a mass event, you just become another number, right? Whereas now people know who you are, and you hold a significant role. Have I got you still?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, that's one of the things I enjoy. Everyone in a running race, everyone's equal on the start line. There is a sense that all that matters is your training and what you've done. But it also prompts terrific conversations. And so I love the chance to engage with constituents over whatever's on people's minds while we're in the start pins or after a race.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting one because you look at people with profile and they seem to really enjoy a mass participation event because they just pretty much fold in and everybody's got to run a distance, whether it's 10K, half marathon, marathon. So back to the politics side, I think I asked you off air, one of the points I'd love to know is how do you align yourself and your values with a party? So is that something that is almost a natural selection and you go, okay, my values align here, so I'll become a Labor politician? You know, just for the layperson out there, how does that even come together?
So I said before, my kind of big issues are fairness, questions around poverty, disadvantage, making sure that we're looking after everyone. So the natural party for me was always the centre-left party of government in Australia, the Labor Party. That doesn't mean I line up with the Labor Party on 100% of issues. And in fact, I'm not sure I know anyone in the Labor Party who subscribes to 100% of the policies. Politics is like team sport. You have a discussion in the locker room as to whether you're going to throw the ball to the left or throw the ball to the right. And then you go out in the field and you play the way that you all agreed in the locker room. And you've got an obligation in the locker room to make the best case for what you think is the best strategy for the team to win on the field. But then you've got an obligation on the field to do what everyone agreed in the locker room. So I'm pretty comfortable with the way in which things work in a party sense. And I love the fact, Erwin, that in being part of a party, you get the wisdom of other people. So you can draw on the truck drivers and the police officers and the surgeons and the nurses and the teachers in the party room and ultimately make decisions where the whole is much better than the sum of the parts.
And does that just make it a bigger extension of society then? You know, like, it looks very thankless, and you know, you're getting more slaps than you are claps, but then does that just make it exactly what, you know, you could go to the local restaurateur and he'd say he'd get more negative reviews than positive because people will tell you what you're doing wrong more than you're doing right? Is it very similar?
I think there's a lot in that. You know, politics, as Aristotle once said, is fundamentally the art of figuring out how we live together. It's no simpler or more complicated than that. So working out how you form a consensus position in a party is in some sense the one step back from working out how we as a society decide to run things. What's going to be the right level of taxation and services? How are we going to regulate misbehaviour by firms? How generous are we going to be to people who are down in their luck? All of those values questions come up for a society just as they come up for individuals. And yes, if you're in the public eye these days, you are going to get some criticism. Some of it is just going to be pure vitriol, to which you think about the old Taylor Swift saying, haters got to hate. But some of it is also pretty valuable. So I always find that I learn from being out doing street stalls, doing the telephone town halls, the in-person town halls. And you've got to bear in your mind that even if someone's angry, and even if they're expressing it more aggressively than you'd like them to, often there can be wisdom in that too.
And switching off, you know, running obviously is a great way to do it. But, you know, can you ever at night duck out just in your shorts and a singlet to get some milk? Or, you know, is it how much of it really is public life? Or is it getting away? Is that where it happens? So you go to Durban and you're away, no one knows you. So then you go, okay, I can just switch off. I'm out of the public eye.
Well, I certainly had people in Durban coming up and saying good day, because there's plenty of Aussies in South Africa. But there is a sense of being on show, and that's, you know, one of the benefits and challenges of the job. I'd be happy to go down to the corner store in singlet and shorts. I probably wouldn't do it in my Speedos. So you know, you calibrate these things and enjoy the fact that people see you as theirs. So you know, I've been a representative for the electorate of Fenner, formerly Fraser, now for 13 years, there is a sense in which people have grown up thinking of me as their local representative, and I'm the person that they expect to get things done when an issue comes to the federal parliament. So, you know, I value that for all of the challenges that it brings.
And then, what questions sitting on the porch or the rocking chair? What do you want your legacy to be?
I would like to leave a legacy of a kinder politics and a more thoughtful set of public policies. I'm really passionate about thinking of how we change the character of the political conversation, which can be too angry and too fractious. And I'm concerned that an angry, fractious conversation makes us more short-term. You know, when we're scared, we hunker down, we just worry about the immediate challenges. But actually the long-term challenges, climate change, artificial intelligence gone wrong, nuclear war, these sorts of things require a bit of calmness and a bit of focusing on the next generation and the generations to follow after that. I'd love to be helping us build a better feedback loop within government, to be a little bit more modest about our ability to design policies from the get-go that are going to work, and more scientific and critical about how we evaluate what we do. That's the approach I take with my training. I'm constantly looking for bits of evidence that will help me do better in training. And so I think we ought to apply the same philosophy to how we assess policies. And I'd love to have a politics that was a little less fractious, because when politics is less angry, we're better able to think about the long term, to be a little bit more modest about our claims, and ultimately, I reckon, just to do a better job.
No, nice. I always like to ask the rocking chair question. But,
it's a great one.
People have asked me a couple of times too, and seem to just roll out. Let's get running, hey? Let's talk about that. Some of your experiences, you rolled them off before. What do you put, I suppose, in your top three? And then what do you have as a bucket list as well?
So my quickest marathon's 2:42 in Tokyo. And it's also the marathon that I ran happiest. I was reading Haruki Murakami's What I Talk About When I Talk About Running on my iPhone on the start line. I just had a little arm sleeve, so I ran with the phone. And in Tokyo, they put you in the pens for quite a while. So I think I had probably 40 minutes of reading it in the pens. And he's all about the idea that once you get to a certain age, the pleasure isn't beating the quick young things. It's just being in the race with them. So I just ran happy and tried to enjoy each kilometre as they unfurled. Now, this is kilometre 12. I'm never going to run kilometre 12 at the Tokyo Marathon. So let's really enjoy it. And it turned out to not only be happy, but also quicker than I'd run before. I relished Comrades. It's the only race I've done which is dominated by an African field. The start pins, they had South African songs being sung by the blokes around me. Joyous spirit as you start off, the energy of the race, and the tradition of the thing, which has been running for over 100 years now. So the start, you have have chariots of fire being played before you run off into the pre-dawn light. And then probably third would be the Cradle Mountain Lake St. Clair run, which is just insanely beautiful. There's only a few dozen people that get to do it each year. I was lucky enough to do it this year, and it was just a remarkable run all the way down. You've got to carry quite a bit of equipment because obviously it's pretty hard to get people out. But having walked the overland track when I was a kid, to have the chance to run it through was just amazing.
I'm always intrigued with Comrades and an international runner. What resources did you use for information? Who did you reach out to, or did you just go in blind? How did you educate yourself?
Rob DiCostella put me in touch with Bruce, who's one of the Aussie ambassadors, known as Digger. He suggested which hotel to stay at and a bit more advice about getting to the start line. But Comrades throws lots of information at you, and it's not very difficult. For the World Marathon Majors, everything you need's in the kit. After you've run a few marathons, you pretty much know which gels you need, and so it's just a matter of going out there and enjoying the new city. I'd highly recommend for people Berlin, which is circumnavigates the city, and you get to see all of the neighbourhoods. New York, which is predominantly a run through Queens, which just is amazingly diverse, all the different bands along the side, and London, where the bridges seem perfectly timed to give you just a beautiful opening there, just as you need a break, and the ability to finish, and as you finish London, think, oh yes, this last little section of the marathon I'm only running because back in the original Olympic marathon they decided to take a 26 mile race and make it a 26.2 mile race so it could reach the Royal Box.
How do you get the mileage in? You're not running a 5 hour marathon, you're definitely getting moving. A marathon, let alone, but also a race like Comrades. How do you get the training in?
I was run first thing. I remember once asking Tony Abbott, who was the fittest man in Parliament for a while there, how he managed to combine high-level exercise with being opposition leader. And he just said, look, if it doesn't get done first thing, the diary swallows the exercise. You've always got to get it done first thing. So work out when your work needs you to wake up and then work backwards from that for your exercise. So typically if I can get in an hour and a half session, then that sets me up pretty well. Try and do some intensity. So I've got a 100, three Chinmoy 100K race on Sunday, which means I've been doing tons of hill sessions. After that, the next race will be the Busselton Ironman. So I'll be doing a mix of swimming, cycling, running, and where I'm doing running, I'll be trying to do more interval sessions in order to improve the intensity on the flat.
Nice. People often ask what you've learned about yourself through running. Ultras normally teach you something about yourself. Is there anything you learned recently in your ultra or
even in general, you know, have you learned anything from running about yourself that you weren't aware of?
I suppose I've learned that I've got a reasonable pain threshold, but also just the joy of trying something that you don't know if you can finish. I'm a terrible swimmer, Owen. I'm a half decent runner, an okay cyclist, but a terrible swimmer. So I've always struggled in the swim legs of the triathlons that I've done. But in Canberra, Sri Chinmoy does a 10-kilometre lake swim from one end of Lake Burley Griffin to the other, and you've got to have a kayaker next to you, so you're pretty safe. I figured I'd give it a shot. So one of the things that I learned out of that was that if I put in enough training, I could swim for 4 hours. Like I said, I'm not quick, but the sheer pleasure of getting towards the end and thinking, "Damn, I'm actually going to make this. This was amazing." That was good fun, and that's something that's nice to be surprised by when you're on the wrong side of 50.
Yeah, and then, if there's anything you're going to put on your bucket list event-wise, is there something that you just sitting right at the top of the shelf that you'd love to tick off?
Oh, I've been very lucky this year in doing two of my bucket list races, the Cradle Mountain Run and Comrades. Mad props to my wife, Gwyneth, for allowing me the time to train and race those two. I've been obviously any triathlete would love to compete in Hawaii. Kona is getting harder to qualify for now, though. So I think the chances that I qualify for Kona when I race Busselton at the end of the year are fairly slim. There's always something tempting about running the Athens Marathon, where the whole caper started. And one of these days, I wouldn't mind giving Paris a shot just for the sheer beauty of the thing. I'm open to suggestions for what ought to be on my bucket list for the next few years. I've been lucky enough to tick off a lot of the ones I wanted to try.
Yeah, it's the training of Ironman, I think, as well, trying to fit that in. So, I mean, I'd be intrigued to see how you go with that conversation with your wife. But I suppose the benefit of the holiday in Hawaii might get you across the line.
Yeah, so Gwyneth let me do another 2 years ago, and then after that she said there's only one race I'm going to say no to, and that's doing another Ironman anytime soon. But she hands in her PhD this month, and so she was willing to let me do Busselton. I was, though, acquainted to the concept of Ironman divorce when I did my last one, and I'm very keen to avoid that scenario.
One of the questions I like to ask a guest to finish up is, if you had a message to your younger self, what would it be?
Think about relationships more than ideas. I was pretty passionate about ideas as a young, politically active thing. I don't think I overstepped badly. I think I probably could have paid more attention to the importance of the relationships that I was forming with other people in Young Labor, in Sydney University debating, in these other contexts where we were tangling around ideas. So one of the bits of advice that I'm always giving young folks who are in these kind of political debating contexts is just be gentle on your opponents and recognize that even when you're on the opposite side of them on an issue, they are still pretty amazing human beings. I do wonder too, what would have happened if I'd continued training at the intensity that I did through my teens into my 20s. There's a bit of me that wants to give the more trivial advice of try a marathon. Because if you can do 2:42 when you're 45, maybe you could run quicker when you're 25. But I'll never know the answer to that one.
Well, the potential is, like, I've spoken to a few friends about this, and they go, "I wish I got into something earlier. I wish I did this earlier." And you go, "Yeah, but you might have also lost the joy by now as well."
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's obviously came into your life for a reason at the time it did. So potentially you'd be moved on with running, and you might be onto something else.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. So I could be fat and washed up and sitting on the couch watching bad movie reruns. Yeah. We should be thankful for where we are and recognise that as some doors open to close, others open.
Yeah, we don't want that. Still plenty of running left in those legs, mate. So, well, thanks so much for your time and for a little bit of chat. I know you've got a busy schedule, and I'm glad we finally ticked this off. I've been waiting a couple of years to finally get in touch and get the confidence too. So I appreciate you filling me in your schedule, and I think the listeners will like to get to know somebody who's representing them as well.
Real pleasure to chat, Owen. Thank you so much.
Cheers. All right.